This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Hello everyone and thanks for tuning in to the December episode of Radio Astronomy. I'm news editor Elizabeth Pearson and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
Production editor Neil McKim.
Hello.
And staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
As we reach the end of another year, we've decided to take a look ahead to the coming 12 months in this episode and find out about the biggest missions that will be sending spacecraft across the solar system in 2020.
Yes, 2020 is set to be a pretty big year for spaceflight. But while most of the missions are going to be kind of travelling outwards across the solar system towards planets and moons, I've been looking inwards as there are two spacecraft currently scheduled to launch next year that are going to take a closer look at our host star, the Sun. One of them is the ESA's Solar Orbiter mission, which is scheduled for launch in February 2020, which is going to provide close-up observations of the Sun. And it's going to kind of mostly be looking at the heliosphere, which is really the Sun's kind of sphere of influence on the solar system, which actually stretches like kind of far beyond the planets. You know, it probably actually stretches a lot further than many people might think. So this spacecraft is going to be launching in February 2020, as I said. So I think it's going to take about like 2 years to get to its orbit around the Sun. It has to do lots of kind of orbiting around Venus and Earth, you know, kind of using their gravitational pull as kind of slingshots to get it outwards, because anyone who's kind of familiar with them, you know, those kind of robotic investigations and kind of solar system space flight, it's never as simple as just traveling in a straight line.
Because in order to get to a certain orbit is basically how far where you are from the Sun is linked to how fast you're going. So in order to orbit closer to the Sun, the spacecraft has to change its speed. And it has to change its speed by a lot. I'm not 100% sure exactly how much the solar orbiter is. But I know when you're looking at things like the BepiColombo mission to Mercury, which is currently on its way, that's taking 7 years because it has to catch up with Mercury, essentially. It's an incredibly fast planet.
Yeah, I mean, they're called gravity assist maneuvers, aren't they? And it essentially comes down to the fact that there's no way of braking.
Yeah.
You know, like you can't just slam on the brakes and then you go, right, we're at Mercury, yay.
Yeah, no, you have to kind of steal a bit of a planet's momentum or get a planet to steal a bit of your momentum, depending on which way around you're doing it.
Yeah, because I remember like reading about like that's one of the reasons that the Voyager mission was kind of put forward and it suddenly became possible, because you can use the gravitational pull of a planet to speed you on, but you can also use it to slow you down.
There was a grand alignment for that, wasn't there?
Exactly, yeah.
It's actually, I think it was Voyager 2, only recently actually passed out of the heliosphere.
Mm. Exactly. Yes, so that kind of gives you an idea of just how big the heliosphere is. But so the solar orbiter is going to be, it's got a highly elliptic orbit around the Sun between 1.2 AU and 0.28 AU, AU being astronomical units, which is the average distance between Earth and the Sun. And it's going to make a close approach to the Sun every 5 months. And being so close to the Sun, it's going to be looking at the solar surface features and how they're kind of connected to the heliosphere, how the Sun kind of creates this heliosphere and also maintains it. And it's going to be measuring like the magnetic field, the solar wind, which is this stream of charged particles that emanate from the Sun, capturing UV images and analyzing the structure of its corona, which is the outer surface, and coronal mass ejections. But I suppose it all kind of comes down to this desire to know how the Sun affects well, both the solar system, but ultimately life on Earth.
Mm. It is an important thing that people like to research, because the sun does affect Earth in some fairly obvious ways. So like the sun's particles hitting the Earth's atmosphere and magnetosphere creates the aurora. But also, particularly now that we've become a much more spacefaring race, space weather can really affect satellites and even the humans that are out in space. So it's one of those things that we need to be aware of, and being able to know if these things are happening and predict space weather could be in the future just as important as predicting the weather on Earth.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was actually reading, I mean, because we've kind of this year we've had the Apollo 11 50th anniversary celebrations, and I was reading that I think it was like maybe somewhere between Apollo 16 and 17 that there was a massive solar eruption. And had there been astronauts on the moon at the time, it could have been quite disastrous. But at the time, I don't think people really knew that coronal mass ejections existed, or if they did, it was still very very early on in the science.
It was one of those things. They did this early Surveyor missions, which were the robotic missions that went to the moon before Apollo. They measured the radiation on the moon and discovered that it was way way too low to be any kind of damage to humans. But it's actually now the thing that a lot of people are concerned about is these kinds of one-off things that can suddenly go across a spaceship and cause a lot of damage.
Hmm. The second solar mission that I have to mention also next year is from the Indian Space Research Organization, the Aditya L1 mission, which is planned for launch in April 2020. And it's going to orbit in the Lagrangian point 1, which is about 1.5 million kilometers from the Earth. And as far as I understand it, the Lagrangian point is this kind of sweet spot between Earth and the sun where the gravitational attraction of the two bodies is equal. So it can kind of rest there. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be an Indian space mission looking at things like trying to discover why the sun's corona is so hot, and kind of studying the magnetic field, and kind of ultimately contributing to our overall picture of solar science.
Mm. The corona is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it's so much hotter than the surface of the sun.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of one of the big questions of the of the Aditya mission. Mm. Apparently, the corona is over 1 million degrees Kelvin, while the solar disk itself is about 6,000 Kelvin. So it's kind of, why is the corona so much hotter? That's probably one of the things that
it's one of those big mysteries of solar system science. Is nobody has any idea why, really.
What is going on there? It's very strange, isn't it?
Mm. Is there a danger it could get too close and kind of get...
I think you have to be, because it is actually so hard to get in close to the sun, they have to be trying to get in so close. But I remember talking to the people who are making the solar orbiter, and there's all of these different things that you have to consider, because it's actually it's coming in quite close and then swinging out quite far away again. So it has to be able to cope with the really hot temperatures close in and make sure that all of the welds and things aren't going to melt when you get back close. Apparently that's what kills your spacecraft from the heat, is it just falls apart. Mm. And then it has to swing out and be able to deal with these very, very cold temperatures as well. And that's one of the biggest problems that they've had.
Temperature variation. Yeah. Similarly like plumbing at home.
Well, I've been looking at Mars missions next year. It's quite an exciting time because there's a launch window in July that only occurs once every 26 months. And there's some key missions planned for this launch window next year. The main one is the Mars 2020 rover, which is a partnership between NASA and ESA. And this intends to collect samples from the planet's surface and cache them, ready for future missions to bring them back to Earth. Mm-hmm. Some of its features are worth a mention. It's the size of a car, about 3 meters long, and it's got two microphones, and it's hoped that these will record the sounds of Mars for the very first time.
Cool. Sounds of Mars has been like a Mars podcast.
There'll probably be
like a Mars 2020 podcast, won't they?
Whenever they do these, but I remember they released the sound of a comet. It was like the singing of a comet.
Oh,
it's like,
yes.
Oh, that sounds terribly romantic. I'll listen to it. And it's like this clicking arachnid monster from outer space.
Oh, no.
It's terrifying.
And there's also 23 cameras on board, which NASA say will give us a front row seat during the landing.
Great.
So that's exciting as well. And it's also going to carry the MOXIE, which is an experiment a bit like a tree that will create oxygen from Mars's carbon dioxide atmosphere by breathing it in and then exhaling it as oxygen.
Very useful.
And the idea is that this will help create breathable air for human visitors in the future. But apparently, NASA say the current MOXIE is about the size of a car battery. And you'd need one about 100 times that big for human settlement.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. But,
So is this actually a biological plant, like an actual grown plant, or is it...
No. It's a bit of kit.
I think it's
a mechanical thing.
It's a mechanical thing, but from what I understand, it's based on the kind of biological processes and things. Mm. It's using that kind of knowledge to then do something mechanical that you can use and grow.
So I wonder, is the idea to kind of work out whether or not you could, for example, plant a forest on Mars to actually absorb all the carbon dioxide?
The problem that you have with just planting stuff on Mars is that there is carbon dioxide there, but the atmospheric pressure is so much weaker than it is on Earth that it just, even though the atmosphere on Mars is almost entirely carbon dioxide, there's still not quite enough for a tree to survive. And trees also use oxygen as well as carbon dioxide. Yeah. So it's kind of, you need both, unfortunately.
Isn't there an issue with radiation as well? And actually the nutrients in the soil aren't there, are they?
Yes.
Because I haven't had that.
There's eons, no bacteria in the soil.
Eons of leaves falling and kind of decomposing and creating nutrients.
And hopefully joining that rover is the second half of ESA's ExoMars expedition, the Rosalind Franklin rover. And this is aiming to look at evidence of past or present life on Mars. And to do this, it'll be digging down 2 meters to conduct its experiments.
Mm. 2 meters. That's huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like drilling for oil.
Yeah. It's one of the biggest drills that's been put on a space mission.
Wow. So is that even deeper than the InSight lander?
The InSight lander should go down 5 meters. It is currently managed about 5 centimeters.
Oh dear.
And that's kind of like, that's a one-off. So once it's in the ground, it's not going anywhere.
Ah, okay.
But it's been having a couple of issues. And I think that they're trying something fancy with like pushing things against, using its robotic arm to try and push the hammer down. But Rosalind Franklin is a drill.
So can it kind of like drill down and then come back up and then move somewhere else?
That's the idea, is that it can take samples from 2 meters below the surface, where hopefully any microbial type of life might have been be protected from the harsh radiation of the sun.
Yeah, because it's landing on an ancient waterbed, isn't it?
Yes.
Nice. So it all comes back to this kind of how wet was Mars in its ancient history and could it have...
Is there anything there in the wet environment?
Yeah.
Isn't there a helicopter going to Mars this year?
That's on the Mars 2020 rover.
Oh, right.
There is the Mars Scout helicopter.
Wow, that's so exciting. I cannot wait.
Yes, that one is basically testing a new kind of way to... Because when it comes to exploring planets, you've got the rovers and the landers, which get up really close but can't go very far. And then you've got the orbiters above, which give you a really wide scale view. And so the idea is that you've got these kind of like drone-like spacecraft that can fly hundreds of meters in minutes rather than taking months to do it.
Because, I mean, the Mars 2020 will have a top speed of about 0.5 kilometer an hour or something, won't it?
Yeah,
it'll
it's very speedy.
Along. But this helicopter, I mean, it'll be able to go and it'll be able to travel up to some quite high altitude and land on some quite high altitude features, hills and outcrops and things.
That's the other thing. Wow. It can go to places, like rovers can only go to places where it's safe for them to rove.
Yes.
And landers can only land in places where it's safe to land. Whereas as a scout can drop down in some fairly treacherous terrain, which unfortunately treacherous often means interesting. So hopefully that should help
fill in some
of the gaps of our knowledge.
I'm hugely excited about that. I cannot wait.
And there's also a Chinese mission which they're very secretive about it, but apparently it's a probe called HX1, which is also going to be looking for evidence of life past and present. But as with the Rosalind Franklin rover, there's a bit of uncertainty about whether they'll actually be able to get there, because the Chinese Long March 5 rocket has had problems in the past, so they may have to push it back to the next launch window.
The last thing I heard about the Long March 5 is that it's due to make its first launch in December, so before the end of this year, 2019. And if that goes to plan, then it should be back in action. So fingers crossed for that one. With Rosalind Franklin, that one is having some issues with its parachutes, its landing system. So back in 2016, the Trace, 2017, the Trace gas orbiter got into orbit around Mars and dropped off the Schiaparelli lander.
That was a tester, wasn't it?
It was a test lander. It did not go well.
just as well it was a test.
Crashed a little bit. They think they fixed the problems with that one, but now they're having new problems with the parachute system. So everybody's a bit cautious about whether or not Rosalind Franklin's going to make it off the ground in 2020, or whether it's going to have to wait until 2022.
But it's the Rosalind Franklin is ready, isn't it? It's completed.
The rover itself is fine. It's being, I think it's going through its very, very final tests.
Yeah. So if it has, it's just going to be put in storage and kept in a kind of clinical conditions, and until they have the parachute.
I think that's the thing that's really frustrating, is there's all these spacecraft that are ready, but they might not be able to go because they haven't got a ride.
Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
But on a good note, apparently with the Mars 220 rover, 10.4 million people signed up to have their name transported to Mars.
Wow.
Including Brad Pitt.
Nice. That's pretty good.
One of those is me, I think. Yeah. I seem to remember doing that a while ago.
Brad Pitt's in good company then.
Mm. Yeah.
Very good. So, yeah, I've been looking at sample return missions next year, because 2020 is a pivotal year for the two sample return missions currently out there in the solar system. And there is a third one launching as well. The two currently out there in the solar system are the Japanese Space Agency's Hayabusa 2 mission and NASA's OSIRIS-REx. Now, Hayabusa 2 in 2020 is due to arrive back at Earth. So at the end of next year, in December, it's gonna arrive back at Earth. It's gonna jettison its sample return canister to re-enter the atmosphere and be collected, and then prized open, and the contents carefully taken out in a sealed environment and sent off to be analyzed. But that's been an interesting mission, because when they got to the asteroid, its target, in 2018, and they found that it was too rocky. It wasn't dusty enough. So they wanted to collect, obviously they needed a certain type of sample to collect for its apparatus to work, the collection apparatus, and they spent quite a lot of time finding the right bits, but they did. And it also had a projectile on it, which they fired into it, blew a crater in this asteroid Ryugu, and then collected some pristine material as well. So it's got two canisters of material in there. And it also put down a couple of scouts on the asteroid, which were did some analysis, in situ analysis on the surface of the asteroid. One of which was really cool. It was like a box, just a kind of metal, a metal box, but it could move around the surface because it had a kind of weighted arm inside it. And because the gravity is so low on an asteroid, you don't need that much momentum to actually move an object. So this thing just spun around and it kind of flipped over, and it's very, watching a video of it is a very weird, it's like a very simple animation.
I love the fact they call those hoppers.
Oh yeah,
because
yeah,
you can't
right. yeah.
you can't call yeah. it a rover because it doesn't really roll anywhere or it doesn't rove. Yeah. It hops.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Then OSIRIS-REx. What's happening next year with OSIRIS-REx is it's going to actually take its samples. Next year, scheduled for the summer. Now, OSIRIS-REx had the same problem as Hayabusa 2. When it got to its asteroid, it found that it was too rocky. These darn asteroids, they're just not living up to expectations. OSIRIS-REx went to its asteroid, which was called Asteroid Bennu, expecting to find what they expected was a to quote the NASA, a beach-like area. I don't know. It was going on a bit of a jolly, I think.
Mm.
but then it was obviously a bit too rocky. So the mission scientists spent a long time mapping the entire asteroid, searching for areas where there was suitable material for its collection device. And it's going to send down almost like an elephant's trunk. It's going to set down this kind of long, like a tube, like a metal tube, and then it's going to release a burst of nitrogen gas, which is going to upset the small grains in these sample areas, mm-hmm. and then it's going to suck them up with a vacuum into its collection chamber. Now they've selected four areas already. They're going to whittle those down to two over the coming months, and then press go on to descend and take the samples. So yeah, it's going to be pretty exciting.
I think that's one of the things that really interests me when you kind of compare those two missions is the kind of very different sample collection missions. The kind of the Japanese one is basically firing what's like a bullet, a projectile, and collecting the debris. But then the NASA one is kind of blowing air at it or gas at it, compressed gas to collect
that's
them.
Right.
I wonder why the why the kind of two methods are so different?
It's if you actually look at the way sort of those two agencies conduct themselves, you've got the Japanese Space Agency, which is a relatively young space agency. Mm. It hasn't done a huge amount of missions. So it tends to sort of try new things and think of ways of doing things on a smaller scale. Mm. Whereas NASA has this entire back catalogue to draw from. So it tends to take its time over things. It makes things like much bigger missions. But it's also then kind of locked into doing things the way we've always done them.
Yeah.
It's really good that you've got these kind of two things side by side. So you can, but apparently both of them have been working really closely together as well.
Cool. Sharing expertise.
Expertise. And there's been various, you know, consultants from one team going across to the other to go and see how they do it and then coming back across.
Yeah.
And then I think they also have a deal to share some of the material that they when they do finally get back to Earth with it.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting because both these asteroids, Ryugu and Bennu, the two are targeting, are both near Earth asteroids.
Mm-hmm.
So they for some of their orbit, they pass very close to Earth, and that's why they were both of them were selected.
Mm-hmm. Easy to get to.
Yeah, I should say that the last one that I mentioned, which is the mission that's launching this year for sample return, is from the Chinese Space Agency. Again, we don't know much about it. We know that it's launching for the moon, but that it is dependent on a functioning Long March 5 rocket.
Yes. We'll see how that one goes. Meanwhile, I've been looking at slightly closer to Earth at the human spaceflight that's been making progress in low Earth orbit.
Mm.
So most of what's been going on at the moment has been based around the International Space Station, as pretty much all human spaceflight at the moment is. The big thing at the moment that NASA are working on is their Commercial Crew Program. So this is SpaceX and Boeing are trying to finally get approval to build and go into full-time production with Boeing's Starliner and Space's Crew Dragon, which is going to replace the space shuttle and the Soyuz for getting astronauts from the ground onto the International Space Station. Everybody is saying that everything's on track, but it's the first scheduled flight of one of these commercial crew program flights is in May 2020. Mm. And so far, neither of them have done a human flight test. Boeing still hasn't done an uncrewed orbital flight test. Everybody seems very confident that they will shorten up the deadline and get there in time. But basically, there's no room for error. Mm. If anything goes wrong, then NASA are going to be left without a ride to the International Space Station for a while.
Have they basically ended their contract with Roscosmos and the Soyuz?
So I believe they've done the sort of like ongoing rolling contract that's finished. They've, I believe, got some kind of backup deal in place. So if there is, if it's not ready by May, SpaceX's flight is in May 2020, then I think there is a Soyuz that they can use, or there's like a spare seat and they can put one person on that, but maybe not the full complement of crew. But they are very much relying on there being those seats available. So hopefully nothing goes wrong.
Fingers crossed. It wasn't SpaceX is developing a Starliner as well, isn't it?
Yes, there's the Starship.
Starliner
is the Boeing one.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And there's Spaceship 2, which is the Venus Virgin Galactic one.
Yes.
Not that people like to name things confusingly. but yes, the spaceship, I think, Starship, which is the SpaceX one, which is, they unveiled it and it looks like what you think a spaceship should look like.
It's shiny, isn't it? It's amazing.
It's very shiny. Yeah. It looks like a children's drawing of a rocket.
Yeah.
And that they say that SpaceX are saying that they're going to be able to send their first humans up in that in 2020, which annoyed some of the people at NASA who were saying, well, can you sort out the one that we've paid you first, please? There were some heated Twitter exchanges there. But yes, that one is going to sort of form SpaceX's main workhorse. It's going to replace the Falcon 9, which is their main launch vehicle at the moment. Yeah. Elsewhere in human spaceflight, there's also the Orion. And this is another case of a spacecraft being ready, but maybe in want of a lift, because it's going to use the Space Launch System, or the SLS. And again, NASA is saying that everything's on track and should be ready. However, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine has made several comments referring to a 2021 launch for the Space Launch System. So people are a little bit suspicious about what's going on there.
There are significant parts of that, of the SLS, have been made though.
Oh yeah,
the main kind of fuel tanks. And
yes,
the
most recent sort of announcement that they made on that one was on, I believe it was the 6th of November. They'd attached the engines.
Yes,
which are a fairly major part of your rocket.
Pretty important.
Yeah. Pretty important. Yeah. Just one giant engine, really.
Yeah.
And so it might be ready in time. The idea is that's going to launch in June 2020, and that's going to form the Artemis 1 mission. Orion is NASA's crew capsule, which is supposed to be a much more long-distance thing. So that's going towards the moon, perhaps eventually even further onwards. It's much bigger than these crew ones that they've got to take people to the ISS. And this was supposed to be the first test of that. So we'll have to wait until a bit closer to June 2020. To see whether or not that one gets off the ground or not, but hopefully it will.
Do you think we are actually kind of approaching this stage where space tourism will become a reality in our lifetime?
I think that there's definitely, there will be some space tourism, but I think it's still, it being something that's achievable for the average person.
Yeah.
It's still quite a way off.
Yeah, that's a way off, isn't it?
Would you guys go on a kind of holiday to the moon? Not actually physically on the moon, but, you know, like maybe, you know, like an actual kind of space flight.
If somebody else was paying.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd definitely go on a like a Virgin Galactic. I'd love to go on Virgin Galactic. Yeah. I don't know whether I would go up to the International Space Station.
I think it'd be really scary.
If you could get an off-peak return, it'd be...
You might not have long to wait for the Virgin Galactic flights, though. No. They're supposed to finally start... Well, they always say this every year. It's like, no, this is the year. But apparently the I'm not going to say they're going to fly passengers, but they are going to fly people this year.
Yes.
Apparently the sort of the CEOs and Richard Branson and all the top brass are hoping to cash in their tickets this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there were a few occasions on maybe, the space shuttle, but definitely the International Space Station when like the odd billionaire would just pay and go and spend a bit of time on the ISS.
It was, you know, sort of like if you had a spare, I think it was about $25 million dollars lying around. You could pay the Russians to send you up.
Yeah.
You still had to go through like 6 months of training to make sure you just didn't get in the way.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And you had to pass a fairly strict like...
Yeah, you had to have physical.
You still had to pass the physical. Yeah.
The training schedule was quite rigorous.
Did you have to learn Russian, do you reckon, if you didn't speak Russian?
Well, seeing as it was the Russians that were sending you up, probably.
Yeah, probably.
But I think most of the people who did do that kind of space tourism thing, it wasn't just as a lark. It was, I am willing to commit 6 months of my life to do this.
To achieve the dream.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of us looking forward to next year. But for this episode's interview, I've been looking over the next decade, because one of the big stories of next decade is going to be the construction and development of the giant Magellan telescope, which is being constructed currently in the Atacama Desert in Chile. It's due to be completed by the end of the decade, and construction is already underway. I spoke to Robert Shelton, who's the president of the Giant Magellan Telescope, to find out how the project is coming along. And I started off by asking him exactly how big the telescope is and what sort of work it'll be doing.
The Giant Magellan Telescope, let's call it the GMT for shorthand, it will be one of a new class of super large ground-based telescopes working in the optical and infrared wavelengths. It will have a collective diameter of about 25 meters. This primary set of mirrors consists of seven segments, each 8.4 meters in diameter. These are the largest mirrors that can be made anywhere, and they are fabricated at the Caris Mirror Lab at the University of Arizona. It's important to note that two of those mirrors are already completed, and the next three have been cast and are in the various stages of polishing. And then mirrors six and seven, we have all of the materials for those, and they'll be cast in 2020 and in 2021 collectively. So we have made excellent progress on the mirrors. The telescope will be located in Chile, in the north of the country, right at the southern end of the Atacama Desert, at a place called Las Campanas Observatory. It's an altitude of about 2,500 meters, 8,000 feet. And the whole thing will be enclosed in a giant structure, 60, 65 meters tall. We are anticipating that we will have first light in 2029, and then all seven mirrors will be loaded in by 2030. I think it's important to note that this project is very international in scope. We have 12 institutions, eight from the U.S., two in Australia, one in Brazil, and in Korea, South Korea, of course. And these are the institutions that have funded the work, the vast majority of the work so far. I think those are the basics of the mechanics. At the site, we have cleared the site. We have excavated. Done the complicated hard rock excavation that was completed earlier this year. And in fact, in 2019, we've seen a number of milestones achieved. The first one I just mentioned was completing the hard rock excavation. We already had sleeping facilities, dining facilities, recreation facilities for the workers up there. We have, of course, water and power and internet. Earlier this year, we issued the contract to build the core, the guts of the telescope, called the telescope mount assembly. This is a contract that we competed over about a 2 to 3 year period with a lot of reviews. Finally selected a team that consists of MT Mechatronics out of Mainz, Germany, and Ingersoll Machine Tools out of Rockford, Illinois, in the States. The contract is right now about $135 million, and this will be the, as I said, the core of the telescope. It's about a 2,000-ton entity that will hold all the mirrors and all the instruments and the highly precision for the observing. So 2019 has been a big year. Now, I guess finally, the other sort of behind the scenes to most people, behind the scenes accomplishment was a rigorous external review that took place over the first 5.5 months of this calendar year from experts outside of our organization. And they concluded, very importantly, there are no technical or scientific barriers to building this instrument and that we have a team that can build it. So we're feeling very good about 2019, and we're going to roll up our sleeves and see if we can make the same amount of progress in 2020.
It's fantastic. And it all sounds like it's coming together really well. I was really interested to, when I was reading about it, to hear about the multi-mirror design, because isn't it the case that rather than having one absolutely huge mirror, you're having lots of small different mirrors and they will kind of combine to create one massive aperture?
That is correct. We will have seven mirrors. Some of the other designs have hundreds of smaller hexagonal mirrors, but in this case, we take advantage of our partner, the University of Arizona. It's the only place in the world that can make these 8.4-meter mirrors, 8.4-meter diameter mirrors. And so we will combine seven of those in sort of a flower petal-like arrangement, a center one that would be a typical a parabolic concave mirror, and then six around the outside, which are off-axis mirrors. And that was one of the first challenges. Could we polish the right shape into these off-axis mirrors? I was actually president at the University of Arizona when the first mirror polishing was being done. And so you could say it was a tense time, but in fact, it all worked. And the second one was completed much faster than the first. You know, practice makes better. And so now we are ready to go with all of the mirrors. We've shown that that can be done. I think it is one of those great advances that the engineers, the people that understand how to phase the mirrors, the software engineers, they all come together to make this possible.
Yes, I suppose the other really interesting thing about the telescope is its location. I mean, why choose the Chilean desert?
Yeah, the conditions in the desert, the Atacama, are overwhelmingly the most favorable on Earth for ground-based optical infrared astronomy. You have a number of features that are really critical. First of all, you have minimal water vapor, very, very dry. Water molecules absorb important parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that that we'd like to observe. We don't want them to be absorbed. So first of all, it's dry, it's high, and you have a very constant wind flow coming off the ocean up and over the Andes. And so you have minimal disturbance by the atmosphere. You know how the atmosphere causes images to wiggle. Well, that's not good for astronomy. And so you minimize that. And then you combine it with the adaptive optics techniques to take all of that wiggle out. And then finally, the infrastructure for observatories is very strong there. We estimate that by 2030, when this telescope comes online, when others are online, Chile will probably host as much as 70% of the ground-based observing capabilities in the world. So it's just an ideal location. The other thing I would say is we're not too high either. We're only at about 8,000 feet, 2,500 meters, and so it's a very comfortable place for people to work.
I'd have to say, though, that one of the disadvantages of having your telescope and such a massive telescope in the Chilean desert must be getting all the constituent parts out there and assembling them. It must be quite a job to actually transport all these massive mirrors and the huge structures out to such a kind of remote location.
Yes, you are absolutely right on. And I will say that just about everybody I talk to eventually comes around to the question of how do you get a 17-ton mirror that's with its protective box, probably weighs closer to 35 tons, how do you get that from Tucson, Arizona to the top of a mountain in Chile? And of course, the tongue-in-cheek answer is very carefully, but basically you put it on a special truck and you drive it to the port of Houston. And then you put it on a ship and you run it through the canal and down to the port in Coquimbo, La Serena in northern Chile. And then you take a number of days to drive up the highway and then on up into the mountain. So, yes, the assembly is done over time with great care. But one of the advantages we have in that regard is we can start our engineering studies and even our science studies with three or four of the mirrors. We don't have to have all seven to get launched. And so once this telescope mount assembly and the enclosure are up on the mountain, we will start loading in the mirrors. And as soon as we get four in there, center mirror and three perimeter mirrors, we will start to do the science. And then as the other mirrors are completed, they'll be shipped and loaded into the mount assembly. The other thing I would say is with the excellent telecommunications in Chile, eventually there will be remote observing opportunities. The bandwidth will be so strong that you can do remote observing from the comfort of your own laboratory. So there is a lot more to come. I mean, we're excited about getting launched, but I want to emphasize the lifetime of this observatory is probably close to 50 years, maybe longer. And it will get better and better over time because the instruments will get more and more sophisticated. The advances in solid-state electronics, advances in data processing, data management, will all allow the telescope to be even better 30 years from now than it will be when it starts. And, of course, by being on the ground, you can make all of those improvements and enhancements at a cost that is reasonable.
So I suppose that's one advantage over building a space telescope. You know, with a ground-based telescope, it's a lot easier to kind of repair and remodify.
Yeah, exactly. One of my previous roles, I was on the Hubble Space Telescope Oversight Board, and when Servicing Mission 4 went into play, and it was a fantastic mission, and it just paid off big time. But each of those missions is about $1 billion. And so when we want to add new instruments, the next generation of instruments to the telescope, it won't be inexpensive, but it will be tens of millions rather than a billion.
I suppose when most people think of the Atacama Desert in terms of astronomy, they'll probably think of the European Southern Observatory in ALMA. Are there any plans to collaborate with ESO?
You know, it's very important that both of these telescopes are there. I was able to go to the groundbreaking of the European Extremely Large Telescope. It's about an hour flight north of where we are. And right now, the two are working hard to complete their telescopes. We're in contact with each other. Each one will have certain advantages, I'm told by my astronomers, be able to focus on different things. So I foresee great complementarity. The trend now for all of these telescopes, the current big ones, 10-meter, 8-meter scale, and the new ones, is that once you have the data, the people that collect and pay for the data have a proprietary period to utilize it, and then the data become public. And so that way you have more collaboration. Heck, sometimes even have amateur astronomers accessing the data these days and finding things that we might not otherwise. So I envision good collaboration once these telescopes are built.
Speaking of data capture, we should definitely talk about just exactly what the telescope will be able to see and what you kind of hope, what sort of cosmic mysteries you hope that the telescope might be able to discover?
Yes. I like to sort of bookend this with two examples. At the end, that gets cosmologists, the professionals, the astronomers really excited is, of course, with the bigger telescopes, you can look farther back in time, right? I mean, the speed of light is fast, but it's not infinite. And so when you're looking at far objects that are farther away, you're looking back in time as well. And with these telescopes, certainly with the GMT, we're able to look back to within a few hundred million years of the Big Bang. And so that gets cosmologists all excited, understanding the origin of the cosmos, understanding phenomena, when galaxies were formed, when the reionization occurred. All of these topics that will allow us to better understand how our worlds, plural, our worlds got formed. So that's kind of one end, very, very much specialized, but it captures the imagination of the public. Just think about the collision of the black holes and the neutron stars and so forth. At the other end, where the general public really gets excited is the search for life elsewhere in the universe. You know, we have now thousands of so-called exoplanets, Earth-like planets that have been discovered. But with the current suite of telescopes, you're only able to identify that there is a planet. We don't have enough light collecting power to determine what the atmosphere of those planets would be like. And so with this telescope, the GMT, we will be able to collect enough light across the whole optical infrared spectrum that we can have signal-to-noise ratio to determine what elements are in that that spectra. We'd be able to look for signatures of diatomic oxygen, of water vapor, methane, ozone, all of those molecules that we at least associate with the presence of life. And in fact, the first suite of instruments that our governing board has approved and that are being fabricated now, they're spectrographs, and they are particularly well-suited to studying the atmospheres of exoplanets. And so people get very excited about that. And then the final comment is one I'm sure you're familiar with, and that is we'll find things that we didn't know about, which is, of course, why you do science, right? If you could predict everything you're going to find, you probably wouldn't need to do the experiment. And so things will turn up that we can't even imagine, I'm sure.
When you talk about people getting excited, I think one of the most exciting things with regard to something like the Hubble Space Telescope is the amazing images. Are you planning on taking lots of astrophotos and kind of images of the cosmos and things like that with the GMT?
Absolutely. I mean, a little sidebar. My background is the solid state physics, condensed matter. And I used to tongue-in-cheek complain about how the astronomers had such a tremendous advantage over us because of the visual, the compelling visuals that they have to lure young people into studying astronomy. It's marvelous. One of the things I would say frequently is the way young people get interested in science is usually either through dinosaurs or through astronomy. And the more young people we can attract into scientific careers, engineering careers, technical careers, I think the better we are. So yes, definitely.
Fantastic. So what's actually left in the timeline between now and 2029?
Well, we still have to polish MIRS 3, 4, 5. We have to cast MIRS 6 and MIRS 7, but we have all the specialized glass for that. We know how to do it. We have to fabricate the mount. That's going to be a multi-year, but we now have that under contract. And so we know the cost of that. We know how to go forward. We have two fantastic organizations that won an international competition to do this work. We are going to have to let a contract for the enclosure, this 60-plus meter tall building that houses everything. And imagine a 60-plus meter tall building, and of course it has to rotate, right? So that's a challenge. There are instruments to be built. We're very far along on a number of instruments, but we have to make sure they continue to make progress. I mentioned earlier adaptive optics. This is the technique that the observatories use worldwide to take the wiggle out of the atmosphere, or the wiggle that the atmosphere produces out of the image, I should say. And so we have to make sure we fabricate our secondary mirrors, right? There's seven primary mirrors. There'll be seven secondary mirrors. And those secondary mirrors are the ones that are the adaptive optics mirrors. And so we have to make sure we get those fabricated and completed and operational. There are additional buildings to be put up there, a building to coat the mirrors, because periodically you have to re-coat the mirrors. So there's still plenty to do, but the infrastructure is there. The high-risk elements have all been addressed and retired. And we'll also need to raise more money. I should put in a plug for that, I suppose. But we feel that with the closer you get to completion, the more people want to be part of a successful story.
It sounds like you've got a busy, even a busy year ahead next year in 2020.
Oh, yes. 2020 and 2021, 2, and 3. It is exciting. You know, one of the things we find, we have about 100 people in our Pasadena office, maybe another 20 or so in Chile. And then, of course, a lot of people under contract that are doing the excavation and things like that. But they're all geared, linked arm in arm for this one incredible project. So it's a very clear set of priorities. Doesn't mean we don't get frustrated on occasion, but the unanimity of purpose is something that is very joyful to see.
Brilliant. Well, I'm really looking forward to first light in about 10 years' time and hearing all the kind of technological advances that you come up with between now and then. But Robert, just want to say thanks very much for speaking to me today and telling us about the project.
Thank you.
That was Robert Shelton, president of the GMTO Corporation. Keep an eye on our website, www.skyatnightmagazine.com, for more info and news on the Giant Magellan Telescope over the coming months.
If you only see one thing in the night sky this month, make it planet Venus, which is now easy to spot over in the southwest after sunset. After the sun is below the horizon, it's good fun to see who can spot the planet first with the naked eye. Venus is in evening skies all month and is visible against a darker sky as December progresses. The planet makes several nice close approaches to other objects this month. It's close to Saturn and Jupiter in the evening twilight on the 1st of December and 1.8 degrees south of Saturn, low on the southwestern horizon on the 11th of December. On the evenings of 28th and 29th of December, look out for the crescent moon lying near Venus, low to the southwest at twilight. These dramatic twilight scenes, with the action taking place low to the earthly horizon, are great things to photograph, paint, or draw. The position of Venus will only get better over coming months, and getting used to spotting it now will tune your eyes to picking it out in the evening twilight.
That's it from us this month. If you have any questions, comments about next year's missions, or need advice on how to best observe the night sky, you can email us on contactus@skyatnightmagazine.com or find us on Twitter at Sky Night Magazine or on Facebook. And you can find out more about the big space missions of 2020 in the December issue of BBC Sky Night Magazine, in which we discover the true source of the Geminid meteor showers, explore the mountains of Venus, and director of the Vatican Observatory, Guy Consolmagno, reveals his top 12 night sky targets to observe this Christmas. That's not forgetting our regular sections where we'll help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky Night Magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night Magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, or Spotify.